What's up, ladies and gentlemen? Welcome to Sports Odds and Ends, the show for the fly-by-night sports fan post-Super Bowl. How are we feeling, VZ?
We're feeling pretty good. The XFL is on.
I was hoping you would go straight for that, because that's why I wanted to have that kind of somber, oh, there's no more football. But wait, there's the XFL.
Yeah, it almost feels like a seamless transition. Like the good football's done. Now you get the, it turns out it was actually still pretty good football.
Let's jump right into this, right? So the XFL, we've talked about kind of what the XFL is doing in its comeback. One of the big things they said is they're going to live within the season after baseball, right? To kind of draw in on the hype of people who are, as my intro tried to portray, sad that baseball is over, football. You know, that post football. I'm sad about baseball too. That post football season, after the Super Bowl, is when the XFL picks up and kicks off as they did. So we've had two games so far. I kind of looked at some of the stuff, but you guys checked out these games. I know DJM said he had them on in the background. What's kind of your guys' thoughts on the XFL?
Well, I think from watching the second game between the mm-hmm. Houston Roughnecks and the Los Angeles, I forget what their name is, but they're a bad team, so it doesn't matter. But the Wildcats,
as DJM says.
I keep wanting to call them the Avengers for some reason, but
that's trademarked.
I think what was immediately evident is that the quality is like at least college football level. And I think that's a stark difference from the old XFL, which I think quality is immediately really bad.
So their CEO, their operations manager, have been going around doing interviews on ESPN and Fox Sports and all these other places. Oliver Luck has been going around doing all these interviews, talking about the caliber of talent that the XFL has now. They have guys who were drafted in the first round of the NFL. They have guys who have led their college teams to multiple championships, or championship caliber teams, and guys who are playing at a high level is what he has touted in all of these interviews.
Well,
come across?
I think so. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that like the Arena Football League doesn't exist anymore. NFL mm-hmm. Europe doesn't exist anymore. Mm-hmm. So like a lot of these guys that would be playing in those leagues or possibly playing in Canada, which the CFL still exists and is still going pretty strong. But a lot of the guys that would be playing in those other leagues or the Alliance of American Football before it folded, they now have nowhere to go. So the XFL is where like all those have kind of, merged, all that talent has kind of merged. And so I think there's, there is an increase in quality. And some of it is like, former NFL players that you recognize that, oh, this guy just didn't make it in the NFL, but you can see that there was some talent there that caused an NFL team to want to take a chance on them or draft them very, very high. So, so we see players like that. I was especially impressed with PJ Tucker. I'm getting that name wrong. PJ Walker. PJ Tucker is a Houston Rockets player who we might talk about later today, but the PJ Walker, who I think threw for like close to four touchdowns yesterday, he put himself on the map. His counterpart on the other side, the Los Angeles quarterback, kind of put himself on the map in the opposite direction. Just by being kind of an asshole that the mics picked up. That's one thing the XFL is doing. They're just putting microphones everywhere. And in the and I think they're letting the broadcasters kind of do their own things with those. The Fox broadcast kind of just put mics everywhere and just captured all of the audio, whereas the ABC broadcast just had their interviewer just interviewing people after everything. Like one guy got interviewed after missing a field goal, like immediately after missing the field goal.
There was also a defensive back that was interviewed right after getting an interception. I will say that was probably the one thing I really enjoyed from a lot of this, JVZ, is that I loved the feel that it was more eventful, but felt like the game was faster and things were happening at a more frequent pace. And with the sideline reporters being there, interviewing players, we're getting mic feeds from coaches, from the referees, from the reviewers, all of these things, the level of transparency, everything continuing to happen in real time. I really, really like that. It felt like everything was moving at a quicker pace. You saw a football league that was definitely in a better place than the AAF, I think. And I think in terms of talent, it is definitely ahead of what the AAF was in terms of talent. You'll see some recognizable names like the Cardell Jones. You'll see somebody that has breakout potential like PJ Walker. You saw guys making actual football plays, and you saw positive reviews for some of the rule changes like the kickoffs where both teams were in different positions when the kicks happened, like with the punts, like with the points after touchdowns. You saw people reacting to these positively in a much different way than the AAF before it or the original XFL. I think that by and large, and I was making sure to keep a pretty close eye on this, boys, it was pretty positive overall for day one for the XFL.
Yeah, I was in the Reddit thread, and it was, I mean, obviously those are kind of super fans, but it seemed overwhelmingly positive, and especially the replay stuff. And I think never underestimate how much sports fans of any kind like to criticize referees, but it's kind of hard to do that when you actually see the overhead booth official like talking through the entire process for why they made the decision they made. I think the NFL has tried to do something similar with like each broadcast kind of has their rules expert that they try to bring in, but that doesn't replace the actual person making the decision and conversing with the referee on the field. Just being able to hear that conversation, like even if you don't agree with the decision they made, it's you at least see their logic. And
VZ, I don't know if you caught this. During one of the games, they actually had a camera in the booth with the reviewing official.
You see them talking. You see the screens that they're seeing. Everybody even noticed that, like, they're controlling the screen with an Xbox controller. It's a remarkably transparent look at the process, and I think that helps take away, like, you know, you can't get too mad at the call if you understand how somebody came up with the decision. And for the most part, it seems like it follows the rules. Like there's always going to be 50-50 calls, but you at least see that they recognize that it's close. So it doesn't seem like anybody's making egregiously bad calls.
So we would say overall XFL positive, at least in the first two games, and from what we see in the entertainment aspect. Obviously, this coming from Vince McMahon and his team, who have been working on this for a long time.
DJM gives it a strong 6 to a light 7. I think I would go with with a 7 to an 8, if you calibrate for, I would say it exceeded expectations. I think, I think the talent level kind of surprised everybody. The rule changes got people excited, and I think they kind of lived up to what we might have expected. I wish we saw more two double forward passes. I don't think I saw any. But other than that, I think it's a success. I think people are feeling more positive about this than the initial reviews for the AAF, which were pretty positive before anybody realized, you know, all the bullshit that was going on behind the scenes. As long as there's no bullshit going on behind the scenes, which is not necessarily a guarantee when it comes to Vince McMahon stuff.
All that is wait to see. But for right now, what we have seen is positive. It looks like a good product, and we just kind of have to wait for the season to play out, I think, and just kind of go from there. So I think right now, XFL, a positive result. Moving on from there, we have some MMA results from last night's UFC 247. I caught a few of the preliminary card matches. There were some really good fights in there. It was a round one 27 KO by Kalen Williams. And just kind of some good fights that went the distance, and just looked pretty good. But obviously no one cares about that stuff. We're here to talk about the main card, because we had two title fights in that main card. We had John Steroid Bones Jones going up against Dominic Reyes, and then Valentina Shevchenko going up against Kaylin Chokagan. I didn't catch these fights, but you guys said that you saw a bit of both of these. How did John Jones look in his title defense going in here against Dominic Reyes?
VZ, you go ahead.
I would say John Jones has just outlasted Dominic Reyes. I caught the second half of the fight, and mostly because Twitter was kind of going wild about how well Dominic Reyes was doing. And so it's like, oh, John Jones might lose. I'm going to start tuning in now. And at that point, that's when Dominic Reyes started getting gassed. And these are 5-round fights instead of 3-round fights for championship fights. So, unfortunately, I caught the part of the fight where the challenger got tired and couldn't sustain the output that he had in the first couple rounds. And
I will say I caught the parts of the fight where Dominic Reyes was definitely holding his own against John Jones. And I believe Dana White has already said that Dominic Reyes is deserving of a rematch, and there's really no disputing it at all. He more than held his own against John Jones in the first 3 rounds. You could make a case that he won the first 3 rounds. And there was a quick knockdown early in the fight, and you could really make a case. Like, the rematch will definitely happen, and then we'll see how it goes from there. But yeah, it really came down to, in the later rounds, John Jones adjusted his game to doing a bit more wrestling and a few more takedowns, and he took over the fight in the later rounds.
Yeah, he's had 11 title defenses, so he's used to the 5-round format. And now he's won more title fights than anyone in UFC history. So, with 14 of them. So once you have 14 of those, you get used to the 5-round format. A new guy coming in and challenging for the title for the first time is not going to have that kind of conditioning. But his second go around he knows what he's in for this time. So who knows how good he can be now that he'll be preparing for that level of conditioning that is required. So
going from there,
I do want to say one quick thing about Valentina Shevchenko. During her fight, she went viral during her fight.
Well, that's what I was going to talk about, because I think this fight. So I think the John Jones fight going in on paper seemed like the more exciting fight. But I think coming out of the actual pay-per-view, the Shevchenko-Chokagin fight, was probably the better fight.
Yeah, agreed.
Yeah, the moment, the viral moment that you guys are talking about is her Shevchenko's kind of spinning back kick that landed square on Chukagian's face, and which did not end the fight, but later the actual fight ending was a ref stoppage after Shevchenko got her in a headlock and just kept pounding her.
And this was after Shevchenko got her with a really hard elbow to the head.
Yeah. So, from a striking perspective, that fight was pretty incredible.
I'm going to go ahead and say it, guys. I think that normally in the fight world, they try and look for, say, an American talent for that breakout superstar. I think Valentina Shevchenko might be the exception. She might have that breakout superstar quality to her. And I think that she could be someone that the UFC could build around. I could see it. I can see it. I'm not saying it will happen, but I can see it.
Well, the thing is, right, I would just love a good consistency of especially for the female fighters, of just names coming up. You know what I mean? Like I feel like every time we get into the female fighting range, it's always they're looking for the one, you know, like, and it can't just be there's a couple of just good ones, you know. Like,
well, there's Shevchenko, there's Joanna Jędrzejczyk, and a few others. Holly Holm is still around. She's still around. She's still competing. She's still pretty good. So I think they have a foundation. But if they can build around that, I think they'll be okay.
Yeah, and that's what I kind of more want to see. I more want to see them build around a series of names, because I think that's what elevates it. I think when you constantly are looking for this one person, it's fun for a while, and then that tapers off, right? Because people are tired of seeing that one person get all the opportunity. So I think when you kind of have a few people going back and forth, I think it just makes better, especially in the fighting game.
Yeah. I mean, if you build around one person and they lose, you end up with the same Ronda Rousey situation that you had before, which was really fun while it lasted. But once it ended, there was kind of an indication that there wasn't that much depth behind her. And now they've actually filled in, so there is a lot of depth. You know, all the names you mentioned, plus Amanda Nunes, who might be more dominant than any of the other ones. So, it's, you know, it's nice to have one dominant figure in the division. Now they got to build out so they have three or four dominant figures. I said the same thing about tennis last week. You know, once you get to the point where there's like four people or so that are all competing with each other at roughly the same level, and then have fans that like to stand for them at roughly the same level, I think that's when a division is healthy.
Yeah. All right. Moving on from there to some new heights. we have a new pole vault world record. What is this world record, and who has done this, VZ?
American Armand Duplantis. The new record is 6.17 meters, which in American units, that is 20 feet 2.9 inches. So I didn't
that's out there.
I mean, I feel like the cameras don't do a really good job of capturing just how high that is, especially since they show these in like overhead cam views, which is like, I mean, like this guy could pole vault over my house, is essentially like that's not just over my house, but like what, like 10 feet over. He broke the previous record by a centimeter. But this is
For some reason, if you're been under a rock and never watched any Olympics ever in your life. Pole vaulting is a person with a very long, flexible pole, and they take a big lead run, and they use the pole to vault themselves up and over a height. Usually yeah. just another soft pole onto a mat. But
yeah, they have to completely clear it too. I think if they touch that pole, usually it'll like knock. If they touch like the pole that marks the height that they're supposed to clear, it'll usually like knock the pole off. So and the pole that they're using to vault themselves looks flexible, but actually those things are
pretty stiff, yeah, because they have to hold the body weight and the pressure of the person. It just looks flexible because of the amount of pressure put onto it. Lot.
Yeah, but those things are scary. And from just browsing the Reddit thread regarding this particular event, some of these people have pole vaulted with Duplantis before, and they definitely have he's got a scary looking pole, because some poles, like if you they're like so thick that if you don't plant them correctly, like they can shoot you off to the side, and you can completely miss the padded area in general. This is a pretty dangerous sport, and getting good at it is pretty difficult. And then when you get really good at it and you need to get really good heights, then it's, then it becomes even more and more dangerous. So Duplantis is, immortalized in the record books. He's going to compete in the Olympics for Sweden this summer.
So when you think about this, right? And like you said, the danger of it, right? You have to launch yourself on a stick, right? Yeah. Up over and then free fall from a height. Like, yeah, it's a big mat, but the amount of things that can go wrong in that amount of time are just crazy. And the amount of things I've seen go wrong in just looking at pole vaulting things is crazy. I've seen people's poles snap in half and like all kinds of things. So it's one of those sports that when you see it, it looks like nothing, but there is so much like precision and science and all these things that go into this. So I think this is an amazing world record. Awesome that somebody from the US is able to hold it for now.
I'm sure
people are working on breaking this
at the Olympics. That's his mother's home country, and I think the trial system, the Olympic trial system for track and field, kind of makes it so that like there's always the possibility that really good athletes might not be able to qualify for the Olympics. So I think he wanted to play it safe, which I guess makes him more room for on the American side for somebody else. But we'll get to see the world record holder at the Olympics this summer, and he'll probably make an attempt at breaking it again. So
and that's on the biggest stage, so then everybody definitely knows who you are, and you get to go on Ellen probably. Moving on from there, let's get into our stories of the week. We got a few things to talk about. We have some Overwatch news, a little bit of baseball and NBA roundup things to talk about, because it's that time of the year. But let's start with this Overwatch news. So we talked about this, I think, a couple of weeks ago. A couple of the big up-and-coming esports have inked deals with other streaming sites outside of Twitch, and have decided to move platforms, Overwatch being one of them. So coming back for their third season of the Overwatch League, they're going to be broadcasting on YouTube now. And this is going to be the first season with home games in quotation marks. We'll see how that goes.
Yeah, that's the actual plan. And I think they did a couple test matches last year in Dallas, and I can't remember where the other place was, but it was pretty successful. So this is the first year that like everybody's moving out of the studio that they were using in Los Angeles, and now, yeah, now they actually have home games. There's actually a purpose to naming all of these teams after cities, and trying to develop a local fan base. And we'll have to see how that goes, but it's already off to a pretty rough start because four of the teams are in China. And right now, there's, you know, the whole coronavirus, scandal, or scandal's the wrong word, but, the outbreak over there. And so now they basically had to cancel all of those home games. I think three of the teams had home games during the next couple months. So,
hey boys, I want to ask you something about the Overwatch League. JVZ, you brought up this point about teams playing in certain locations and what have you. And I'm curious, say, we'll put a timeline on this. Say 5 years. Do you think that this will work out in 5 years to where people in those areas will care and root for these teams? Because in the case with a lot of competitive games, there's such a concentration of talent from certain parts of the world. I wonder, do you think that this will work out? Do you think that this is something that people could really get behind?
Well, I think, I mean, the talent issue, I don't think is such a huge deal just because talent will just spread around. Not everybody has to play for their local team. And I mean, that's the case with most sports that that because of the draft and the way players get distributed, it's usually it's very odd for a player to actually get the chance to play for their local team unless it's kind of towards the end of their career and they just want to do something nice. LeBron is kind of the one exception who got to play for his local team twice, but he can go play anywhere. He's left twice as well. So in regards to the city experiment, it's different than what other competitive gaming sports do. And I think Kaz has alluded to it before that it's so different that it might take people a long time to get used to. But one thing that it does do is it gives an automatic rooting interest. I looked at this list of teams and it's like, okay, which one is the one closest to me? Well, that's the San Francisco Shock. And so if the San Francisco Shock were to hold a local match, maybe I might consider going.
I think you have the pre-installed fan base, right? Obviously, I think from there, what you have to do, especially for the local markets, is you have to obviously do your charity work, right? That's the things that get you on the local news, and have people talk about, you know, what your thing is and is the constant reminder of what it is. From there, I think you have to create some kind of an install base with school-aged kids, whether that's high school and middle school, by maybe having your players go there, hold events where they play against the kids and talk about what it's like to be a competitive gamer or an esport athlete, to get these kids interested in these kind of things. And you do those local things that constantly keep you in the local news cycle. Then from there, it's about selling tickets, obviously, right? And merch and all those kind of things. Those are the harder things to do. But I think initially there's going to be a little bit of blowback. So this
you think Overwatch article, League can pull this off?
No. Not initially, because there's already a lot of blowback, right? So there's a couple of things we have to talk about, right? One of the big things is obviously the move from Twitch, right? Twitch has the pre-installed user base, and then you're going to YouTube, which could possibly give you an opportunity. If you do well in showing the highlights and things like that, it's an easier clickbait to get people to click on a YouTube link. But getting people to watch live things on YouTube has been hard for YouTube itself. So you're coming into it as into competitive gaming as the as still one of the newer guys on the block. So you already have a hard thing there. One of the bigger issues going through this SB Nation article is they've lost a lot of their production talent, casters and things like that, that were already popular. Two of the biggest names is Monte Cristo and Doa leaving the Overwatch League, who were popular League of Legends casters and took a fan base with them to Overwatch League. And now they're leaving Overwatch League to possibly they can have their pick of whatever game they decide to cast or whatever they decide to do from there. So that is a big loss for them. We have always said your casters, especially for esports, are your gateway to people. They're your gateway to teaching new people what the game that they're looking at is, how it works, getting them excited to see it and things like that. So losing people who know how to do that well and possibly either having to steal talent from other places or find homegrown talent is going to be hard because I think right now Blizzard as a whole has a lot of struggles for these kind of things. So it definitely is going to be the biggest marker, is having that talent of people who know how to talk about the game. Like, that's just going to be rough.
Yeah. I mean, they've thrown a lot of money at this, but it's like little things like that that can really harm the viewer experience. So we'll have to see how that plays out. One thing that has harmed the viewer experience in the past is the quote unquote meta and the hero pool that has kind of converged on just a certain number of characters every season, and they've tried various things to try to mix that up so that you're not seeing the same players play the same characters and employing the same strategies every single week, and so the newest way that they're attempting to do that is to actually just ban some of the heroes that they can pick from every week, and they're going to try to ban some of the more popular ones every week. And so, I think it's going to change week to week. So
I think
maybe that'll mix things up.
I think this is another big issue, right? I think this now draws the comparison of Overwatch to League of Legends, right? So League in its growth has gone with going for less story and more gameplay, right? Driven over their years, right? And they've existed on a pick ban style thing for every game, not on a weekly basis, because they have the pool of playable characters for the pros to be able to choose from to do that, right? And you still have guys who are extremely good at one thing, so it always leaves the option for that guy to be able to play that one thing. And then it's up to the other team to have enough strategy to go, hey, let's ban this, let's ban that. It becomes a strategy and part of the game. When it's a thing where there's just a week of games and you're like, no one can play this, I think that's more detrimental than helpful. I think the 2-2-2 thing is also more detrimental than helpful. I think that's limiting your gameplay potential rather than doing what League did and creating a more versatile way of playing the game. Because you have maps that are more conducive to certain types of characters and certain types of play and certain types of things. And it makes it more stale because you're going to then just see people fall in. You can't stop meta. You can only evolve it. And this is trying to stop meta. And that's just never going to work. You're just going to see professional players fall into the things that work the best. That's always what they're going to do. Like, and until Overwatch has more characters for people to play around and play with and try different strategies and allow the meta to shift like League does. This is
something similar,
more detrimental.
There is something similar happening in the fighting game world right now on the side of Tekken. The newest DLC character, Leroy Smith, popular character, everyone loves him. The problem is that it's been shown in the tournament scene and online, he's ridiculously overpowered to the point to where almost there was a tournament recently where 6 of the top 8 players were all playing Leroy. And it's pretty much exactly as you're describing. But to the credit of Bandai Namco, the developers have said that they put out an update just a couple of weeks ago, and they're putting out another. So it does require a certain level of transparency and communication with your player base and your community as to how the meta evolves. Players adapt, and the game will evolve. That's how it should work, right?
And Riot does the same thing with League of Legends, right? Like, they put out a new character recently called Set, and Set has been very dominant in the lane that they designed him for. So much so that they're like, hey, we've looked at this. The math is obviously in his favor, and we messed up, so we're going to adjust it. We're going to adjust it. We're going to give players another 2 weeks of playtime to see how it goes, and then we'll see if we adjust it again. And even to that sense, there's a character that the Koreans have decided is really strong in the top lane that Riot didn't ever see going that way. And they've gone, okay, this has become literally the strongest thing in the game, and we need to adjust our math. Like, and that's how you do it. You don't then go, oh, you know what we're going to do? We're just going to delete that character. We're going to, you know, burn that character from the game or make it so that you can't pick that particular character this week, rather than going, hey, the math is wrong and that's on us.
Yeah. I think the point you're making is that you let the teams decide whether they can or cannot play against that character. It's built into the game of League of Legends that the it's kind of a part that you can skip in the broadcast if you're watching VODs, but the pick ban phase, it's each team gets to select their characters and ban 5 characters from character selection from the other team. And like you said, you do it based off of the types of players that you are playing against, and the types of characters that you think they're going to be good at. And whenever there is an overpowered champion, usually that takes up one or two of the slots, and then it leaves like 3 other bans available for strategic purposes. If you let the people kind of just take care of it themselves, the players take care of it themselves, they'll figure out a way to do that. And Overwatch already does that with the maps, don't they? Like, they let you like pick or ban maps. So yeah, they should just do that with the characters too.
Yeah, I think sometimes you just have to take the best of what you know, right? So maybe do a 2 map ban phase and then a 3, because that's what League started with a 3 character, you know, ban. And maybe you do that, but this just goes to show the weakness in the game that it's designed. Obviously, as time goes on, they'll have more characters, but I think they should have designed this game initially, you know, with a 25 set, and then had a roadmap for putting out a character maybe every month. You know, I think this is the problem with it, is you have such a limited character design because you want to tie each and everything into this bigger story universe, rather than putting out more characters and then, as you go, trickling them into your storied universe or whatever. Like, it has its weak points.
Jump in before we move on, but there just to give some numbers behind this, there are 31 Overwatch characters to pick from. Which to pick 6 from. League of Legends has 132 champions. Actually, no, that number might be low. At least 132 to pick 5 characters from. So there's, you know, just to give you an idea of the scale of the variety difference in between the two games so far, which like you said, that Blizzard will eventually turn out new characters, but they kind of seem to be on like a one every 4 to 6 month release schedule for a new character, which is not nearly fast enough.
It's the problem with striving for perfection that doesn't exist rather than tailoring things to your game. You know, like you put out fun, interesting things, you create a little splash art and splash story. Maybe it doesn't initially tie in because League is only now trying to make their story make sense of their game. Like Overwatch started with that, and I think that was a bad place to start. But that goes onto the shelf of wait and see. We'll see how Overwatch does over on YouTube and with the changes that they have decided to make to the OWL. Going on from there, we have a little bit of baseball news to talk about and then a little bit of NBA news to talk about. Starting with the cheaters, we have more news on the sign-stealing scandal from the cheater Astros because they like to cheat. This news comes that there were documentations, Excel sheets, and other things that were being designed by the front office and people within the front office that were logging and decoding signs that they were getting from opposing catchers and things like that to be able to figure out, you know, what the calls were. Analytics, as DJM says to me. So I look, this is just going to be a thread that continues to become unraveled.
Yeah.
I just feel like at this point we should just ban the Astros for a year. That's my just blanket thing from there. I'll let you boys have the discussion. My blanket thing is ban the Astros for a year.
Well, so with revenue sharing, if you take out the Astros, then everybody loses. So that's the problem with everybody being so intertwined. I think in other
ban
leagues,
ban the Astros for a year.
It's there was a lot of talk about like not enough or none of the players got punished. Basically, the only players who got punished were the former players that are now coaches, who then got fired. This looks like this is more of an organized operation than initially thought. This Excel thing, which was polished enough that they gave it a name, they called it Codebreaker, and
Advanced Analytics.
I think it's sort of under the guise of Advanced Analytics, which then once you tie in like a real time camera. And then the complex system that they use to actually relay that information to their batters. That's when things get really messy. You could definitely make the argument that this particular Excel application is just a, you know, that fully falls into the realm of legal analytics. Like you are allowed to analyze signs, you are allowed to steal signs, you're just not allowed to do it in the real-time way. So you could definitely say that it's just analytics, but also this particular find indicates that the entire effort was probably more than just a player-driven thing that the coaches just kind of lost control of the team and the players just went hog wild with cheating. This is much more of a team effort, of an organization-wide effort than initially thought. So
just trying to win games, trying to gain an edge.
If you're not
just trying to get an advantage.
Trying. Yeah,
ban the Astros for a year. That's what I'm sticking to. That's my contribution. Ban the Astros for a year.
If you're definitely leaning towards that side, there are some pretty damning charts that were floating around. Like some people have actually gone through the 2017 season and they've actually done the statistical post analytics work to log like every time they heard a trash can bang, and you know, and log it by game, when it happened, and like what, you know, what pitchers were affected by it. You know, there's a couple stories of like this pitcher pitched for the first time ever in Major League Baseball. They were brought in like the ninth inning, and the Astros scored six runs on them, and then, you know, and then that pitcher was never seen again. And so it's if you want to take the angrier stance on this, that's definitely ammunition for that. But yeah, for the rest of us, we'll just have to wait and see when how this is all going to play out, how the MLB is going to respond to the latest allegations, and all the buzzer stuff, and whether any of that takes hold. So wait and see for that. Another thing to wait and see on is who is going to buy the New York Mets. It looked for a second like billionaire Steve Cohen was going to do it. It turns out that he initially agreed to this kind of strange deal where he would buy the team, buy a majority stake. He would own the team essentially, but the Wilpon family, who currently owns the team, would be able to continue running the team for the next 5 years. I think once Cohen realized that that's what he was agreeing to, he backed out, or also tried to like renegotiate the deal to like maybe get gradual control of the team over these 5 years instead of just let the Wilpon family, who DGM describes as insanely dumb, rather than let them keep running the team for 5 years while you have to take all the financial risk.
So DGM is asking me about the Wilpon family. I don't know shit about the Mets. I've been just a diehard Yankees fan.
Oh, they're since awful. I was a kid. They're awful. Well, they're.
I mean, just the fact that you, as somebody from New York, doesn't know shit about the Mets is like an indication for how bad the Mets are run. Like,
yeah,
that's it's a New York
they're,
team.
They're the,
you should be
they're
rich.
The garbage team we have to play every, you know, so often because they're there. I know more about the Dodgers because of their time in New York and then moving to LA than I know about the Mets.
I think the Mets are kind of one of those teams where like everybody makes fun of I think there's like one of those teams in every media market that has two teams. Strangely enough, for basketball right now, that's the Knicks.
They're garbage. But,
yeah, there's always like the second team in the city that doesn't quite have the same history as the team that's been around for a long time. So. Yeah, the Mets are that team, but they are still. I mean, this sale was going to be for like $2.6 billion, so you know, just being in New York makes them an attractive opportunity for anybody who wants to invest or just buy the team outright. Looks like Cohen was willing to do that, but because he backed out of this deal, I think that kind of left a sour taste in Major League Baseball's mouth. So. It might be the case where he's kind of blackballed from.
That kind of shit tends to happen. And I think it's just dumb, right? Because you walk into a bad deal and you obviously back out for whatever reasons. And then like a baseball is especially one of those sports where you kind of are given a few chances. And I don't think it should ever be that way. I think. I especially with this one and reading this and then what you guys said, that guy walked into a bad deal, man. Like, that is not a deal you want to walk into. So like I don't feel like that should be a slight against him.
Yeah, and I mean, he's taking the stance that, like, why would anybody put up $2.6 billion and not have a say in the operations of the business he was buying? That's a direct quote, or a quote from a source close to Cohen. So which makes a lot of sense. Like, you know, if the Wilpon family is as dumb as everybody says they are, like, don't let them run the team while you own the team, because that affects how much money you make, and you're coming into this for the purpose of making money, usually.
Yeah.
At least rich people try not to make bad investments in general. Some are more successful than others, but it's getting rid of bad owners is something that every league should strive towards. I feel like MLB missed an opportunity to get rid of a bad owner here. I feel like if they're going to shut out Steve Cohen, that might, he must have done something really bad or acted in really bad faith for them to want to shut him out like this. But
the MLB, I doubt it.
They can be pretty petty sometimes. Like the players can when it comes to weird unwritten rules. The Mets are up for sale. We'll have to wait and see who buys them.
Yeah. Going on from there, continuing our baseball news, with a story DJ broke for us last week, Mookie Betts was in a multi-team, multiplayer trade deal. And it looks like that trade may fall out a little bit due to some complications.
Yeah, a third team was involved in that trade between the Boston Red Sox and the Los Angeles Dodgers. The Minnesota Twins got involved. They were supposed to get Kenta Maeda from the Dodgers, and while also giving up a couple prospects, Brewster Graterol. Was one of those young talented players that was supposed to head to Boston. This is what they're getting back for trading away two of the best players in baseball. They took a look at Graterol's medical records, and I think he's had a couple major surgeries, and so they kind of were hesitant about that, and so now they're feeling like, okay, maybe this guy isn't really a starting pitcher anymore. He's probably better as a reliever. He might be the kind of player that you got to take it easy on his shoulder for a while. So that's causing them to at least try to ask for more in this trade, and so that's caused this entire thing to fall apart a bit. It's not unsalvageable. There's some talk that they're going to try to maybe do this as two separate deals, instead of a three team trade. But there's also a little bit of speculation that because the Red Sox have been so heavily criticized for making this trade in the first place, that they might be using this as a bit of an excuse to back out of this trade. I don't know where I necessarily fall on that, but I do know that they've been heavily skewered for trading, you know, not just a great two elite players, but, you know, like DJ have described Betts last week, he's like the 1B to Mike Trout's 1A, and on top of that, he's still incredibly young. So it just seems like a bad trade. It seems like Boston's giving up, and David Price is still an ace level pitcher, and I think they also paid LA to like half of David Price's salary this year, I think, if I remember correctly, as part of this trade. So it just seems very lopsided, and it doesn't seem like they're getting enough back for something like this. Especially if this is a sign that they are trying to rebuild, they need to be getting a lot more back if they are going to rebuild from blowing things up like this. So it's just not necessarily a good look for the Red Sox. Both from a you made this deal in the first place, and from the thing, now you're backing out of this.
The thing that really doesn't make sense to me, if we're talking about the Red Sox rebuilding, Mookie Betts is only 27 years old. He's not in the downturn of his career. Arguably, you could say he hasn't even hit his prime yet, or he's just entering his prime. That's where it really doesn't make sense.
Yeah, was he in line for like a contract within the next couple of years? Because 27 is kind of around that age where
it was getting there. It was getting there, and the word is he was looking for 40 a year. 40.
Yeah. Okay. Which is a lot. It's but yeah, the type of 40 a year for 10 years type of contracts. One that could, you know, lock him down until he's like 38 or so. So it seemed like the organization is afraid of being put in the position to have to sign one of those contracts or risk him leaving in free agency. And I think they didn't want to get to that point, and they wanted to get rid of him before he got to that point. And I don't know. That seems a bit, I guess, dare I say, cowardly for a team that is 2 years off of a World Series victory. A team that by all rights should be in contention for, you know, the playoffs every year. Just one of the storied franchises in baseball. Just not the greatest look, not the greatest signs for fans of the team about like where this team is going to be for the next couple years. If they are tanking, this is kind of the first signs that might happen, and the first sign that you should just maybe avoid buying tickets for the next couple years. That's one thing I hate about rebuilding when it comes to the way most teams try to go about doing it now. It just tells your fans that you just don't really have to care for the next 5 years.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean it's an interesting thing sometimes because it could just have been, like you said, an interesting value proposition of maybe saving money, not necessarily trying to play bad this year, but maybe just get good players and save money, which is always hard. I don't know.
An organization as rich as the Red Sox should not be trying to skimp out on money. Baseball team should, period. Like, that's the thing that bothers me so much about some of this, is like these teams just print money and yet they act like they're so goddamn poor.
Let's talk about the Tigers and the Illich family, boys.
Yeah.
Oh, look, like, we don't have the time or the
Let's talk about how things started with the Justin Verlander trade.
It's the luxury tax is so weak that no contender should ever shy away from paying it, and yet every team just seems to be running away from it, even the Yankees. And it's it's like a 10% tax. Like, that's nothing. Like, it's bullshit to me, especially when they turn around and act like they're poor when it comes time for labor negotiations. All right. From a baseball trade to a basketball. DJM says that's how billionaires stay billionaires. probably true, but not so great when it comes to the fan perspective. Yeah, I mean, nobody likes losing money. And yeah, when we talk about it as fans, it's like we're spending other people's money. But at the same time, when they ask for our support, it's kind of hard to give it when they seem like they're not giving the same level of support on their end.
Yeah.
For basketball, we just had the NBA trade deadline. So we got to see a lot of teams move around. And some of these were salary cap, luxury tax style moves. The Rockets, the Houston Rockets of Daryl Morey / James Harden fame, are kind of going all in on their experiment. They've got a center, or they had a center, Clint Capella, that they were paying a lot of money to, and they got rid of him plus their backup center Nene, and so now they seem like an NBA team that is devoid of big men in general, which is definitely an experiment that I don't think any team has tried, at least in the modern basketball era. It's very Mike D'Antoni, like DJM says, their coach, who is famous for the Suns' 7 seconds or less offense. D'Antoni's always tried to run a very fast-paced offense. I guess they were playing kind of slow this year. And part of that was just trying to integrate Russell Westbrook, who on his own is a pretty high tempo player. But I think maybe that some of it was just growing pains. But they've been playing slower this year than they've been used to. So I guess, now they're just getting rid of all the big men. So they don't like to call it small ball, but that's kind of the term everybody uses in the NBA when teams trot out a small lineup. Usually that lineup is not a lineup where there's nobody taller than 6'6" in the lineup, like the center that like the Rockets are going with. But it's the Rockets call it skill ball instead.
It's a thing that's been tossed around and talked about a lot in different basketball circles for a myriad of reasons. Usually due to the pace that you can keep. You'll have more athletic, high-paced players that can just kind of run the ball down court before the defense even gets set up and get a few different opportunities. Usually you have a little bit more athleticism in your drive and goes. You have less setup. Like you said, Mike D'Antoni, very famous for the 7 seconds or less, as you said. So it's an interesting concept that has had its flashes before, but I'm still not sure, being that we're kind of coming back into this era of the big man, but we're coming into this era of the athletic big man. So it's very, I don't know if it has its play as it did back in the day, where you kind of had these big lumbering dudes, because now people are a lot more athletic and move a lot better at the bigger sizes as well in basketball.
Yeah, well, and you still need big men for defense, for rim protection, basically, because if somebody's driving the lane and trying to shoot a layup, having a big man there that can alter their shots, because there's the threat of that shot being blocked, that can make a very big difference in like the two main strategies now is shoot threes and attack the basket. If you have a rim protector, that kind of takes away the attack the basket strategy. And it seems like the Rockets are basically going with don't bother with that. Or don't bother trying to stop that. We're just going to outscore teams because all the guys we have on the floor are really good at shooting the three and attacking the basket. And we'll just try to score points faster than anybody else. But it is it's interesting because we all grew up. We're all of the age where we grew up. There were two big men traditionally, and then we got to see it transition into just play with one big man, and then four on the outside. And now the Rockets are going with, now we're just going to play with everybody outside, and then you don't know which of those five on the outside is going to attack the basket, but one of them will, and you don't know where it's coming from. Mm-hmm. On the offensive end, on the defensive end, we're just going to do the best we can. Like we'll put a 6'6" guy against your 7-footer, and we'll tell them to do the best they can. And maybe they don't do so well, but we'll do so well on the offensive end that you're not going to be able to stop us over 48 minutes. And at the end of 48 minutes, we'll have more points than you. And that's all that matters. So who knows whether this is a sustainable solution long term, but it's quite an interesting experiment. Dare I say this is potentially an excuse for the Houston Rockets to fire Daryl Morey at the end of the season if this doesn't work out.
I forgot about that. So for us here at Sports Odds and Ends, we have an on the clock for Daryl Morey due to his whole start of the NBA China kerfluffle, and the NBA possibly losing out on millions, maybe billions of dollars due to a tweet that he made and saying that he stands with the people of Hong Kong, that he did delete and made their rounds of apologies, even having two people who are not known to apologize in Russell Westbrook and James Harden go around and make their rounds of apologies as well. So for us over here at Sports Odds and Ends, Daryl Morey, you're on the clock.
He's a very respected general manager in the league, and in kind of definitely when it comes to analytics circles, he's at least one of the more creative, and so he shouldn't be on the hot seat, but maybe he's trying something radical like this, and if it fails and blows up in his face, combine that with the other controversies surrounding him, and maybe that. Combine that with the fact that the Rockets have a new owner who has been criticized for maybe being a little bit cheap, just like we're talking about for baseball. The NBA is not immune to that either. It might be the perfect storm for Daryl Morey to lose his job this offseason.
All right, going on from there, from the Rockets, which was kind of the big news, we're going to kind of go through a few of these, but we do have some things to talk about with the Pistons, so maybe we'll get a rare DJM take on the Pistons there, but let's run through some of these real quick. So, in other trade news for the NBA, you have D'Angelo Russell going to the Timberwolves. Andre Wiggins is now a Warrior. Andre Iguodala going to the Miami Heat, which I actually think is a good one.
To that Heat squad. As far as the keep getting them checks, Hall of Fame, Andre Iguodala basically got paid to not play this year. He didn't even report really to Memphis, and then he was basically paid to stay in the shadow realm, or I guess he wanted to. To the point where the young upstart Memphis Grizzlies, who are doing much better than anybody expected, basically criticized him a little bit and said, yeah, they don't really need him, that started a little mini Twitter feud, for somebody who has never set foot in Memphis, at least since he became a part of the team, he got paid to do that, and he got a raise, a contract extension as a part of this trade to Miami. So somehow he managed to profit all of this by not playing, and I brought up Andre Iguodala as an example. In comparison to the entire salary of the WNBA, that's the kind of thing I'm talking about. Like like the NBA teams have so much money to throw around, and you know, that you could pay Andre Iguodala to not play and give him an extension the next year when he gets traded to a team he actually wants to pay to play for. Memphis is getting Justice Winslow in as a part of this trade, so I guess win-win for all parties involved, but especially for Andre Iguodala, who got a lot of money for doing a whole lot of nothing.
Going on from there, speaking about doing nothing, the Knicks trade Marcus Morris to the Clippers for nothing, because that's what the Knicks do right now. That's who they are.
They got a Clippers first round pick, which is at this point essentially nothing, but it's
we're where we started. to the West Coast, we have the Kings make a swap, Trevor Ariza for Kent Bazemore. Kent Bazemore, Dwayne Dedman for Alex Len and Jabari Parker. How do you feel about this, being the Kings fan in the room, JVZ?
So Trevor Ariza for Kent Bazemore is like when you swap nothing for nothing and both teams kind of end up with something. Kings fans are really, really, really happy with Kent Bazemore. And I think part of that is just because he's not Trevor Ariza, was kind of a veteran signing that just didn't quite work out. But it seems like the Portland Trail Blazers are pretty happy with Trevor Ariza now. And it's like both teams just kind of signed the wrong veterans in the offseason. I think the Kings are better off when they sign younger veteran players that are still athletic and still pretty hungry, whereas a team like the Blazers might be better off signing older veterans that that are a little bit craftier and do a better job fitting in, because the Kings want to run up and down the court a lot, and Kent Bazemore fits that pace a little bit more than Trevor Ariza does. He's just been a spark of energy since he's showed up. So people have been surprisingly happy with that. Dwayne Dedman was kind of the marquee offseason signing. So it's a bad look to give up on him this early, with not even a full season under the belt. But he demanded to be traded earlier this year after he lost his starting job. He lost his starting job because he sucked. So it's kind of hard to feel that bad for him. But it was a combination of he had a terrible start to the season. He basically forgot how to shoot the three, which on its own wouldn't have been that bad. But he also turned the ball over at an extremely high rate. So that limited the amount of time that the team was willing to play him at all, in hopes that he would, you know, kind of play his way out of the slump. Got to the point where the team couldn't even afford to do that. He did a little bit. Like, defensively, he's always been okay. His shot never came back, but his turnovers never went down either. They went down a little bit, but they were at such a high level before that going down a little bit just wasn't enough. Compound with that with the fact that Rashawn Holmes, who was kind of a nobody offseason signing for the Kings, turned into an amazing player in you know, replacing him. So, you know, not only was he playing bad, but the people that replaced him ended up playing extremely well. So so he wasn't getting a lot of playing time. He wanted out. The Kings moved on quickly. It was a bad decision, but I guess.
Well, I think it's one of those things, right? Initially, sometimes guys look good on paper, and when you're starting to put yourself in a position where you're playing to win, which I think the Kings are, they're trying to jockey for that position to actually start playing to win. You don't have a lot of time for turnaround, right? You don't have a lot of time for development because you want the right here, right now kind of guy. And I think Dwayne Dedman initially on paper looked like that, but then when you actually suited him up and put him in a uniform, he wasn't that. So I think the move on may initially seem quickly, but when you don't have the time for player development and you're looking for the guys who can develop a little bit faster, that's what happens. And those guys won out. They're the ones playing for the position. So now you have to get rid of those kind of players. I do think getting rid of Trevor Ariza is always good. I do think Trevor Ariza only has a couple of ever good weeks in him ever. And then he kind of falls off usually later on in the season, which is why he has moved around as much as he has in his career. I don't know much about Alex Lynn or Jabari Parker. Jabari Parker is a name I have heard. I am familiar with, but
that's because Jabari Parker is always injured. He's former number two overall. He was, so Andrew Wiggins and Jabari Parker are two names that we're talking about. Both have been kind of disappointing in their careers. Andrew Wiggins kind of had a mini resurgence earlier this season that we talked about. And maybe we talked about that a little too early because he's tailed off again. Jabari Parker was picked just after him. DJM calls him the Sam Bradford of the NBA. Just a talented athletic player that has never quite
stay healthy.
Yeah, he can't stay healthy. Also, a direct quote from him, or maybe not a full quote, but he said something along the lines of players don't get paid to play defense. So, I guess for some reason the Kings have been trying to get him before. They don't necessarily need him now. He'd be just kind of a piece coming off the bench. Alex Len is a useful but not really inspiring big man. So that still might be more productive than Dwayne Dedman was this season. It seems like the last couple games, at least the last eight games or so, which with maybe a couple bad performances that turned good this year. I mean, the Kings have won six of their last eight games, but went on a lot of losing streaks before then. So they are still in a really bad position. 538 puts them at a 2% chance of making the playoffs in the Western Conference. But at the very least, the last couple games, they've been playing fun. Which has been, you know, a much better for a season ticket holder like me that has to go to these games and watch them play every single time.
So our last bit of actual trade news is the Pistons swap Andre Drummond, as you put it, to the Cavs for peanuts. DJM is our Pistons correspondent.
Yeah, this is my count. I'm just going to go ahead and say all the best wishes to Andre Drummond. He was a really good player for the Pistons for 8 years. His game never dropped. He was everything as advertised. He was 6'11", 275, big body, elite rebounder, elite rim protector, athletic, strong, and a surprisingly good passer. That was one thing in his skill set that grew that maybe people outside of Detroit didn't know, is that he could pass, he could get assists, he could block when he wanted to, and he could do the occasional point guard things here and there. But unfortunately, on most NBA teams in this day and age, Andre Drummond is probably best as your third or fourth option. He is not and never was going to be a franchise player. And the Pistons trading Andre Drummond to Cleveland for a couple of expiring contracts, Brandon Knight, former Pistons draft pick, and John Henson, both on expiring contracts, this essentially acknowledges that the Pistons are getting really close to doing the rebuild full on.
Yeah.
They'll have a large amount of cap space. Blake Griffin is dead, and he's likely never to return. And there's even rumors that there have been a few rumors floating around that Reggie Jackson might be getting his contract bought out to go to a contender. So this is my moratorium on the Pistons for the next couple of years. The tank is happening. The rebuild is happening.
Derrick Rose has had a really good resurgence in the last few years.
And there was talk about him getting traded, but they were essentially offering peanuts for Derrick Rose, and the Pistons wanted a first round pick there for him, and they just weren't getting it. So it was like, no, we're going to keep him, and we're going to have D. Rose mentor our young guys, because Ed Stefanski, the head of the Pistons right now, said that the rest of the team pretty much idolizes Derrick Rose. So if we're not going to get a respectable offer for him, we're going to keep him, because the Pistons still have him for another couple of years. I think it's another 2 years. So, you know, might as well keep him. And again, Blake Griffin, rest in peace. It was great while it lasted. Man, watching him, wow. But yeah, he's dead. So, and his contract is coming off the books in 2 years. Derrick Rose's contract is coming off the books in 2 years. The Pistons will have, I think, around $30 million next year in free agency. So we're kind of going to see where it goes from here. They are clearly going in the direction this year of the rebuild. So we're just going to see how it goes.
Okay.
And in the case of Andre Drummond going to Cleveland, I think it's a really good fit for him. It might be a really good fit because him and Kevin Love sort of playing the inside-outside game, I think that could work out. I think it could work.
Yeah, at the very least, it'll be a pretty good rebounding team. The Pistons are currently the seventh worst team in the league, so that would put them at that spot for the lottery. So Drummond had, I believe, an option on his contract next year. I think he's making $25 million a year, something like that.
Yes, and the player option was coming up was for 28. And the word is he was almost certainly going to take the option.
Yes.
It's looking like he was going to do that in Detroit, and he's probably going to do that in Cleveland as well.
Yeah, because people don't give up $28 million when they have the option to take it. So it's essentially kind of starting the rebuild a year early in a way. They're blowing it up, but I think we've kind of been talking about will the Pistons blow it up for the last several years? So in a
it's
way,
happening. It is happening now.
It's happening now.
The Andre Drummond trade. The Andre Drummond trade was the indicator of yes, we are doing it, because Tom Gorris, the owner of the Pistons, did not want to blow it up. He didn't want to do it with Stan Van Gundy. He didn't want to do it before he took over. But now that the Pistons have meandered in that area of mediocrity, which is the worst place to be in the NBA, for as long as they have, Ed Stefanski has convinced Tom Gorris, who had a pretty close relationship with Andre Drummond, that it's time. It's time. It's over.
Yeah.
And Blake's not coming back.
I think when people talk about the last, I don't know, seven or eight years of Pistons basketball, they will probably talk about it as if it was the Andre Drummond era, right? Because, I mean, he has been around for such a long time. And, despite all the trade rumors leading up to this, I think he's basically been a fixture of the organization for a really long time. And, Blake Griffin coming in, was a nice supplement to that. But it always felt like, the first name when I think of Pistons players, at least now,
was Andre Drummond. Yeah.
So, but he's he is kind of a if this was the old NBA, or even the NBA of 10 years ago,
he'd be a megastar. He'd be a megastar.
But
Andre cannot shoot the three. Yeah. And nowadays you have big men that can shoot the three. Andre Drummond cannot. So I don't want to say that his play style, his skill set is not needed, but it is, it's something that's a bit more specialized.
He did get better at shooting free throws, and for a while he was the poster child of this is the guy you hack so that that you can get back into a game. And that for a while, like, his skill set matched up with what everybody expected from NBA centers, but and he was good at all of those things, except he could not shoot free throws, so you couldn't leave him in the game late. But now it's a shame that, like, by the time he managed to fix that, the meta for the NBA has shifted to the point where the rest of his skills are useful, but just not as useful anymore. Not at least not enough to justify paying somebody, you know, $25 million or more.
Oh yeah.
Season. So.
So if you guys will excuse me, I'll be doing draft simulations on Tankathon for the Pistons for the rest of the show.
Yeah.
So go ahead.
All right, moving on from there, it is our ends. This is just kind of a funny little story that we decided to throw in here. So Sixers fans have been tweeting their ideas, their trade ideas, and obviously you would think they would tweet them to the Sixers or to the Sixer, maybe somebody from the Sixers front office. No, they're tweeting them to Elton John.
Yep. Well, they're tweeting them at the at Elton official Twitter account, which it does not belong to Sixers GM Elton Brand. It belongs to Elton John, like you said. So just one of those weird Twitter confusion things that, first of all, like, I don't know. I've never felt compelled to tweet anything at the Kings general manager. I don't know. It just doesn't feel productive to direct my criticism that way. Like, it's like, I'll complain all the time, but, like, they have a tough job, so, like, I don't want to pile on. But, you know, I mean, Daryl Morey is very public on Twitter. Maybe a little too public. Other GMs are on Twitter. Magic Johnson, when he was a general manager, loved to spend time on Twitter, probably spent more time on Twitter than he needed to. Elton Brand, I don't think, is on Twitter, but everybody seems to act like he is. And unfortunately, the person that ends up being the brunt of that is another famous person. Who just happens to share a first name. But overall, Elton Brand is doing, I guess, an okay job with the Sixers, kind of taking over for Brian Colangelo, he of the very large collars, the guy who is behind the using burner accounts to criticize his own players on Twitter. Really, just GMs should just stay off of Twitter. That's what I'm discovering.
This is the thing we're learning.
Yeah, but somebody else is going to. It seems like fans want an outlet, so they're going to send those tweets somewhere. And
Elton John's official Twitter account just happened to be the thing that got it.
So, I guess on behalf of Philadelphia 76ers fans, even though I don't really speak for them, I'd like to apologize to Elton John and anybody else who gets the brunt of sports Twitter accidentally when they're just branded when there's a case of mistaken identity.
But you know who you can tweet when you have an idea about a trade, or you have just you need an outlet for your team. Sports Odds and Ends, we're here for you. You can tweet us at our Twitter account, Sports Odds and Ends. You can go on over to our website, sportsoddsandends.com, and check out all the stories that we talked about on this show and much, much more. Don't tweet DJM about your trade ideas because he has his own to worry about. But you can tweet me. I'm at King Kaz. You can tweet JVZ at JVZ. If you have maybe just some solace for any of the Detroit fandom that is happening, you can also not tweet that to DJM, but he's at Call Me DJM for other things. If you just want to watch a man rant about the goings on in Detroit and their sports, just just sadness, I guess, at this point that it is. You can follow those things at Call Me DJM. Thank you for listening to the show. Make sure you join us again next week, where we'll have more sports stories to talk about, more odds, more ends. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for being here. And good night.
All four teams, boys. All four of them.